We'll begin with the lecture verse. The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So good morning and welcome to all, especially our weekend retreat guests. I hope the retreat has been helpful for you. For those who don't know me, my name is Reverend Margaret. And this morning's topic is problems. And following on from that, solutions. We all face problems. They can seem large or small, easily solved or impenetrable. There are a few definitions for the word problem. I'll focus on a couple of them here. First, a problem is a source of perplexity, distress, or vexation. I like that word, vexation. Also, a problem is a difficulty in understanding or accepting. And notice that word accepting, file it away, because we'll be talking about it. A problem can be seen as a difficulty in accepting. So we have problems. The good news is there's always a solution. And I'll repeat this at the end so you can remember it, this quote that I'm about to read. As we continue to practice meditation, we begin to understand that our own mind is making up the appearance of the world and also reacting to it. Gradually understanding this, the mind is not so disturbed by itself and begins to relax. In other words, we can choose to make circumstances or questions into problems, something separate from us, or we can choose to sit still with them, the emphasis on with. We can say yes to problems. Now, this talk was inspired by reading this little book. I was going on retreat, and one of my fellow monks asked me, did I have anything good to read? And I said, not too much. And so she loaned me her copy of this little book, which is called The Truth of This Life, Zen Teachings on Loving the World as It Is. And it's a collection of talks that were transcribed. They were given by the late Reverend Catherine Thanis, who was a teacher in the same tradition as ours, but a different lineage. The first talk opens with a story from the time of the Buddha, and it's called A Farmer Came to See. It's short, and I'll read it now. A farmer came to see the Buddha because he heard that the Buddha was a great teacher. He thought that the Buddha might be able to help him. So he told the Buddha his problems. Too much rain or not enough. His wife nagged him, and he occasionally felt tired of her. His kids didn't show him enough respect. When the farmer finished, he waited for the Buddha to speak and ease his life. The Buddha said, "I can't help you. Everybody's got problems. In fact, all of us have 83 problems, and there is nothing you can do about it. If you work really hard on one of them, you might be able to fix it, but almost immediately another one will pop up in its place. For example, you're going to lose your family one day, and you're going to die one day. There's nothing you or anyone else can do about it." The man, now agitated, asked, "What good is your teaching then?" The Buddha said, "Maybe the teaching will help you with the 84th problem." "What's that?" the farmer asked. "Well," said the Buddha, "you want to not have any problems. That's the 84th problem. And after the story, Reverend Fannis, in this book, goes on to say, the truth and joy of this life is that we cannot change things as they are. Well, actually, there are some things we can change. We can change our views, opinions, and attitudes, for example. But there are many circumstances that we can't change. We are all going to die someday, and we have to accept that. So the truth and joy of this life is that we cannot change things. Notice the word joy in there. Perhaps you may not find yourself feeling joyful about not being able to change some of the circumstances that come up. War, poverty, climate change. And this brings me to my master's, Reverend Master G.U. Kennett's teaching, that all acceptance is the key that unlocks the gateless gate. Remember, a problem can be a difficulty in understanding or accepting. So all acceptance is the key that unlocks the gateless gate. And this teaching of hers is so important that it's carved on her tombstone out there. She further said, acceptance means what it says. Acceptance. No movement, either one way or the other. It means accepting that chap with body odor who is sitting beside you and the one who's slurping his soup and not complaining about any of it. No movement towards thinking good or bad, liking or disliking. And she sometimes took it a step further and stated it as uncomplaining all acceptance. That means no smiling on the outside, while inside cherishing thoughts like, one day I'm going to throw that guy's bowl of soup right out the window. Not cherishing the thoughts. This doesn't mean that the thoughts never arise. They do. They're the fodder of our practice. All acceptance isn't necessarily equal to agreement. And that was a good one for me to figure out. I can accept that brutal wars exist in this human realm. After all, they're in the news every day, without agreeing that war is a good thing to do or an effective way to solve problems. Reverend Master G.U. also taught us that all acceptance didn't mean we had to be doormats. Sometimes speech or action is necessary. And to make sure, we're speaking and acting from meditation and the precepts rather than from greed, anger, and delusion. We'll take the consequences of what we say and do. The late Zen master Shunryu Suzuki said, emotionally we have many problems, but these problems are not actual problems. They are something created. They are problems pointed out by our self-centered ideas or views. We all know that emotions aren't permanent. Like everything else, they change and pass. The Buddha taught the truth of suffering, that all beings are subject to dukkha, which can be translated as suffering, dissatisfaction, or stress. And like everything else, suffering has its cause. And the cause of suffering is craving, clinging, attachment. So problems are created by our own craving and clinging based on our selfish views. And by selfish, I mean thinking, having it somewhere in the back of the mind that we're at the center of the universe. I know that one. Oh, sorry. Recall that one thing we can change is our views. Our problems seem all too real. However, the practice of meditation guides us toward seeing their transitory, unreal nature. They're problems because we make them so. Instead of problems, they can be our teachers, gateways to the truth. I'll quote here, just kind of as an aside, a teaching of the great, I believe, 8th century Indian master, Shantideva. If there's a remedy when trouble strikes, what reason is there for dejection? And if there is no help for it, what use is there in being glum? So if we can do something about a problem, we can do it. If not, what's the use in worrying about it? What good does that do for anyone? Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, was the crown prince of a nation. He possessed great intelligence, a handsome appearance, and athletic skill, as well as tremendous wealth. He had a beloved wife and baby son. And together with all this, he had a problem. Legend has it that he went out into the town near his palace, and there he saw the four sights: an old person, a sick person, a corpse, and a monk. This led to distress for him regarding the problem of suffering. Why is there suffering in this world? What can I do about it? He left the princely life behind, at emotional cost to himself and his family, and went out to seek for the truth, which he eventually discovered while sitting beneath the Bodhi tree. Great enlightenment opened his eyes to the truth of suffering, its cause, the cessation of suffering, and the way to the cessation of suffering. In brief, we accept that suffering exists, and we cultivate its cessation, not just for ourselves, but for all beings, by letting go of our cherished attachments. And in our tradition, we do this by meditating and keeping our precepts. I'll return to Reverend Thanis, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce her name, for another story. This one concerns the late religious teacher Ram Dass. In Ram Dass's book, Still Here, he describes a trip in India on a very slow train. He became impatient, thinking, this trip is going to be going on forever. This present moment will never end. I've been on this train my entire life, and I will never, ever get off. Now what? As he meditated on these thoughts, he began to surrender into the rhythms of the train, slowly dropping his anger. He noticed the part of himself that yearned to slow down, to move to the rhythms of earth and sky, the coming and going of generations. And he also noticed the part of himself raised in the West, accustomed to material life and great stimulation. So have you ever been on a slow train? My slow train was elementary school, where everything I was asked to do was either way too easy or impossible, too hard, and I had little interest in any of it. I'd sit in my desk in class looking at the big white clock on the front wall and watching the second hand creep through the minutes. An hour was interminable. Funny how that changes as the years go by. As a little kid, I wasn't able to solve the problem of the slow train. I tried counting the holes in the ceiling tiles or the squares of linoleum tile on the floor. I tried playing various mischievous tricks, like passing a note saying, everyone drop your book on the floor at 1 o'clock straight up. Although these tricks were sometimes entertaining, they often ended up with me in the principal's office being instructed to write something 100 times. It took growing up and learning to meditate before I began to see my way through this slow train problem. Now, here's another story from Reverend Thanis, one that especially our weekend guests might be able to identify with. She's talking about intensive meditation retreats that she attended, and those are called sessions in our tradition. And she attended these at the monastery called Tassajara, which is in the hills south of, way south of here. She says, during my early sessions at Tassajara, I had an experience like that, like the slow train. Our sitting periods were 40 minutes long, and you learned to sense by how your body felt just when it was time for the bell to end the period. And when the pain was really strong, you would find yourself anticipating the bell, barely holding on until the period was over. Many periods, I couldn't imagine going a minute past 40. And then one day, the bell did not sound. I kept thinking, any time now, but minutes went by, and I gradually realized that the bell wasn't going to sound. At first, there was panic, and then, very unexpectedly, release came. Release into just sitting there. The holding on, the wanting to be out of that experience, was creating more tension. Accepting and releasing into just what is, being willing to settle into just the experience. This is the teaching of saying yes to our life, not giving in to thoughts of another life. We learn that our resistance strengthens whatever we want to avoid. One thing you may have noticed in that little story is that she doesn't resort to blame. There's no thought of, what's the matter with that bell ringer? Did they fall asleep? Did they just forget? What are they thinking? Nothing like that. Experience has shown me that blame doesn't solve problems. It may seem to bring a momentary sense of relief, but it will spring back on us. Cursing the bell ringer doesn't solve the problem. My master said to me, "The universe is not answerable to your personal will." Apparently, I thought it was. I think I still sometimes do. But anyway, putting what we think of as ourselves at the center of the universe gives rise to many problems. What if the universe doesn't do as we think it should, for example? It often doesn't. What if the train or the clock moves too slowly or too fast? What if human beings fight each other, torture each other, shoot each other in schools and malls? And then, going from the terrible to the ridiculous, what if people turn the air conditioning temperature so low that I'm cold all the time and have to wear a sweater in 90-degree weather? I know we have some people from Florida here. I believe we do. Hi. And I lived in Florida for some time, and that was my experience in Florida. I worked in the schools, and they kept the schools very cold. So I would have to be carrying a sweater around with me, and it would be 91 outside. So this is actually a problem for me, just as being too hot is a problem for others. This little book includes some teaching on the following story from Great Master Dogen's Shobo Genzo. And for those who are new to our practice, Great Master Dogen was the Japanese monk who brought our tradition from China to Japan in the 13th century, and the Shobo Genzo is a compilation of his talks. If you're interested, you can see it on our website. This story refers to a koan, which means a spiritual problem or question. And here it is in chapter 64, on spring and autumn, warming up and cooling down. Great Master Tozan Ryokai was once asked by a monk, "When cold or heat come our way, how are we to avoid them?" The master replied, "Why don't you proceed to the place where there is no heat or cold. The monk then asked, "What is that place where there is no heat or cold?" The master answered, "When it is cold, give yourself up to the cold. When it is hot, give yourself up to the heat." This koan tells us to take the situation as a meditation, not as a problem. And I agree with this approach. I find that it's what works best for me. And I confess that I still haven't solved the hot and cold problem for myself, although heat really isn't part of it. But although, thanks to meditation practice, it seems to be declining in intensity. That's the good news. What is that place where there is no heat or cold? Although I've glimpsed it, I haven't yet learned to dwell in it as my master was able to do. And I'm working on it. I have a low tolerance for cold. And from an early age, my health has occasionally been harmed by exposure to cold. Although this seems like a real problem, I know in my heart that the real problem is my reaction to cold rather than cold itself. Another version of the verse I just read says, "When it's cold, be killed by the cold. When it's hot, be killed by the heat." And I can sense in myself a strong fear of being killed by the cold. Perhaps I picked this up from a previous being. Perhaps I saw it in a movie. Perhaps it's my imagination. Whatever the reason, there's a persistent fear of being killed by the cold. Sometimes I find myself staying out of the meditation hall in an attempt to avoid being chilly in there. Now, I know that's defeating my purpose, as meditation practice is the true solution for my problem with cold. So I've finally gotten beyond complaining about the complaining usually to myself, but probably sometimes to others, about the temperature in the hall, and decided that why don't I wear a sweater beneath my robe? It may be 80 or 90 degrees outside, but that's okay. I'll be warm enough to sit in the hall. And I'm confident that continuing my meditation practice is showing me how to live in the place beyond heat and cold. When Reverend Master Jiyu spoke of all acceptance, she described it as no movement, either one way or the other. Another way to describe this no movement is to say sitting still in the midst of conditions. Those who are here with us, and I apologize to those viewing the recorded video, can look into that shrine over there. Well, I can't even see it myself because there's a lantern in the way. And you can see the painting of Achalanatha, the great immovable one, sitting still in meditation in the midst of a bunch of flames. He could just as easily be pictured in the midst of a bunch of snow and ice. He'd be sitting just as still, no movement either one way or the other. Now, I'd like to close with a couple more quotes. I'd like to repeat the one from Reverend Thanis that I used near the beginning of the talk. As we continue to practice meditation, we begin to understand that our own mind is making up the appearance of the world and also reacting to it. Gradually understanding this, the mind is not so disturbed by itself and begins to relax, or I might say, to let go. And finally, some words of Suzuki Roshi. Nothing outside yourself can cause any trouble. You yourself make the waves in your mind. If you leave your mind as it is, it will become calm. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.